Good day to you. Welcome to Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. I'm John Marino. We are produced by Shark Creative, made possible by our good friends at Robeson Oil, the house that service built, by Hightower Westchester, managing your wealth to a fiduciary standard, by White Plains Hospital, and by Michael Labriola Landscape Design and Construction of Armonk. Here we are on the Sports Report with our annual tradition of getting an opportunity to sit down one by one with all of the upcoming inductees into the Westchester Sports Hall of Fame. The class of 2023 of the Westchester Sports Hall of Fame contains five very distinguished Westchester sports legends and icons. For example, Mount Vernon basketball coach Bobby Cimino is one. Also, former high school football star Sammy Maldonado of Harrison, one of the all-time great football stars, fabulous running back in the state of New York over at Harrison, and he played in college at Ohio State and in Maryland, too. A guy who came out of Hastings High School, became a Super Bowl champion with the Tampa Bay Bucks, and Tom Brady, two-way lineman in high school at Hastings and offensive guard for the Bucks, spent his entire career in Tampa Bay, Allie Marpet. Also, lacrosse coach from Yorktown, Jim Turnbull, and we're joined here this time around by women's basketball pioneer and longtime official Margaret Muggsy Frena. Muggsy, thank you for joining us here on the Sports Report. Now, you were a real trailblazer in women's sports, especially in the sport of basketball. That was what got you to where you are today, to be inducted into the Hall of Fame in November 15th at Glen Island Harbor Club in New Rochelle. How did everything begin for you? Where were you born and raised, first of all?
I was born and raised and still live in the city of Yonkers.
How did you get into, as you worked your way up through the school system, which schools did you attend, and how did you get so involved in athletics?
I attended St. Eugene's Grammar School, and in those days, they only had varsity girls basketball, 7th and 8th grade. I was in the 5th grade. My sister had begun to coach the 7th and 8th grade, and I badgered and badgered and badgered her until she allowed me, as a 5th grader and a left-handed player, to join the team. Mm-hmm. And just as a sidebar, in those days, this is the truth, the rules were 3 defensive players and 3 offensive players, and nobody could cross the line. And you could only dribble 3 times. So it was a very different game of basketball than what we have witnessing, what we witnessed today. In the 7th grade, they changed the rule and they allowed each team to have 2 rovers. And being I was at St. Eugene's, I pulled out my rosaries. I asked my whole family to play, get the rosaries out. I want to be chosen the rover. I want to be the rover. I want to cross the line. I want to cross the line. And I was the rover, and it completely changed my love of the game. Believe it or not, I felt that I had no restrictions because I was allowed to dribble more than 3 times. I was allowed to go across the line, offensive player, defensive player. And my sister was the coach. So it was a wonderful mix. My father had coached my brothers there. My older brother coached my younger brothers there. So it was a St. Eugene's CYO community that in the Gray family was very integrated into.
Yeah, I grew up in East Harlem. We kind of played like that, where if it were a half-court game, the defender could not cross the line. They couldn't cross the foul line, and you could do whatever you want. If you had the ball behind that line, you could shoot, you could dribble, crow. Once somebody crossed the line, you could go after them. But I thought it taught you offensively to handle the ball a different way, maybe working a little more, take a little more time to figure a play out. Or if you were a shooter, gave you the chance to develop your game long range. And on defense, you had to figure out a way to make it work without being able to cross that line. And that when somebody did cross that line, you picked them up hard and fast, first of all. Or if somebody was a shooter, you had to really work on your jumping skills, I thought, and I used to do this kind of cheat and lean in, almost like submarine my way across that line to maybe even tap somebody when they shot. I thought it taught you a lot of different skills that way.
It probably did. I think it also, it was just the way things were then. The game of girls basketball was designed by Naismith's assistant in 1896. She was a female, and she said, I want to start girls basketball program at this, at where they were, wherever they were, I can't remember, in Massachusetts. And he said, yes, you can, but you have to make it your own game. So it started out a very different game. And then obviously over the decades, it's evolved into, you know, a much more interesting game for the spectators, I think, and certainly for the players.
By the way, I think you've attended a Hall of Fame induction ceremony before, right?
I certainly have. It was quite the honor. My sister was nominated and inducted in, I believe it was 2019, posthumously, as the winningest female coach in Westchester County, 37 years of coaching multiple sports at Holy Child and Mercy College. And it was quite the honor to stand there and to think that this is happening is, gets me.
Mm-hmm. You had a pretty interesting Thanksgiving dinner one time, right? Over at the house.
Oh, yes, I did, John. There are five children in my family. So I have four siblings and my parents. And my father played semi-pro baseball, but he was a coach at St. Eugene's. My brother was a coach at St. Eugene's. My other brother coached with my sister at Mercy College. So our dinner table was the referee up against all the coaches. My mother was tending to the turkey and she tried to stay out of it. They had to really remain neutral. But there were times I had to bring my NCAA rule book to the dining room table to try to make them understand, you know, you have blinders on, you're a coach. I don't care who wins. This is what the rule is.
Uh-huh.
So we had, you know, years of that type of banter back and forth, quick phone calls. I think this ref was wrong. Listen to what happened. And I'm rolling my eyes. You know, I wasn't on FaceTime or anything. And I just, referees have a different perspective of the game than coaches. You know, coaches have a dedication to their players, and they tend to sometimes, you know, have a little bit of blinders on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had a lot of discussions at the dinner table, right? But the way I got into officiating was I played high school at Good Counsel. I played at Mercy College. Mercy College in those days, we had to buy our own uniform. So we all wore cutoff jeans because we weren't going to go buy anything. And we bought our own t-shirts from the bookstore and we drove ourselves to games. It was such a very different situation from today.
Did you ever have to whip out the rules book at the dinner table and say, here, page 46, article 8, section 15?
Well, sometimes what I would do, and they really never knew it, and if they listen to this, they are now going to know it after 40, this is my 49th season, I think, or 48th, 49th. Sometimes I would just say to them, no, you're absolutely wrong. Go to the book, you check rule 2, section 14, article 3. I had no idea what that was. But that always kept them quiet.
Uh-huh.
They were like, oh, okay. And I, some coaches may be listening to this. There have been times where I've done that on the court in my early days where I know I'm right, but I can't, we are not supposed to take our rule book to the table because that was seen as you're not really sure. You have to look something up. You have to. So with your sense of confidence that you're supposed to project, we were trained, and, you know, don't bring the rule book to the table. And I was in a situation where it was a correctable error, which is a very complicated rule. And my partner, who was a seasoned official, got very nervous. And he said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I said, I'll handle this. And I went over to the coach and I said, we're taking away the foul shot. It's based on the correctable error, rule 3, section 2, article 4. And I think it might be letter H. I said, but this is how it's done. And he completely just backed off and said, okay. And I went to the locker room. My partner said, what are you talking about? Correctable errors is in rule 2. I said, I know, but I had to just calm the coach down because it was correctable and it needed to be fixed. And I had to make up some numbers. I'm not recommending, and I'm sure officials do not do that today, but in my early days when you needed to get that point across, sometimes that was the best way.
Mm-hmm. I work a lot of public address at high school games around the tri-state area, game on Long Island. this past season, situation came up where the ref whipped out the rule book over at the scorer's table to look something up. And I said, carry the rule book around with you, don't you? He said, I have to. And I said, this is an odd situation, but these things come up. And said, unless you got the answer for me, I got to go to the book and look it up. How did you get into officiating?
Well,
that's something you really, I think, have to have a love for to do it, just because of everything it entails. And first of all, as a ref, do you say to yourself sometimes, wish I was playing right now instead?
Oh, I did for a long time at the beginning. And I think that's really how I got into officiating. When I graduated college, I had been playing basketball since the fifth grade, and there was no place for me to go play basketball again in a team setting. There weren't even really women's recreation leagues that far back, because this goes way back.
And when and was this?
The fall of 1974 is when I found myself with no more basketball in my life. And I had just come off at 1973, New York Knicks, went to like 42 games. And it was the love of the game that I felt that I missed so much. And my sister, Kathy, who was coaching at the time at Holy Child, and she was a CYO ref. But truthfully, when I was in high school, I didn't like referees. And apparently, I really didn't know this, I made a face if they made a call on me. And I had a referee come over to me, a female, and said to me, you're a very good basketball player, but you have to stop with that look every time we have a call. And I thought, referees. And I did, as a teenager, think they're against us. They're not doing the right thing. In college, I changed my opinion a little bit, because I saw more female referees and would talk to them. And my sister kidnapped me in the fall of 1974. She said, come on, we're going for a ride. And I was like, okay. And we went to Mercy College, to the athletic office. There was a few women there. And all of a sudden, I was taking a New York State, which was a national, at those days, it was a national test to become a ref. And I was like, I don't want to be a ref. I don't like referees. And she talked me into it. And we worked together on CYO. And I was also doing BOCES games my first year in. And I think it was the love of the game that, and it allowed me to stay with the game in a very, very different way. But I had, with the knowledge of basketball, I knew pretty much when a coach is going to call a timeout. I knew pretty much this kid's getting hot under the collar. Let me see if I can privately calm her down. You know, try to, my theory is, let's prevent whatever we can prevent from happening that is going to be negative. Let's, you know, just calm things down, de-escalate. I was kidnapped against my will to become a referee and fell in love with it.
Here we are today. Did you ever ref against your sister? When she coached, I should say, with your sister coaching.
I did on two occasions. She was coaching at Holy Child, and I got an emergency phone call that some ref that she had coming, something happened. Could I get up to Rye and do her game? And I said, not unless you clear it with the other coach. Clear it with the other coach. When I was a player in high school, we would play against Holy Child, and she was the coach. And my parents would come, and they would stand behind the scorer's table at half court so that they didn't look like they were rooting for good counsel, or they didn't look like they were rooting for Holy Child. Sometimes there were tight ropes, but it was all in good competitive fun. I don't think any of us ever thought, I lost and she did this or I did that.
In those games where you and your sister might have looked at each other a certain way?
Well, you know, my sister was the type of coach who, as a referee, she would almost aggravate me. Because as a spectator, I would be watching her games, and I'm an official, and I'd say, she needs a timeout. Why isn't she calling a timeout? Why doesn't she call a timeout? And she wouldn't. She would make her kids like work it out however she taught them. And when she did question an official, you better go to your book and check, because I would say 90% of the time she was right. And I had my colleagues who did work there often, and they'd say, when your sister has something to say, he said, we all stop. We have to listen, because there are some coaches who know the rules so well that if they question you, like Gina Marr is one of those, just as an example, because I did one of my very first games at Irvington
over at Irvington. Yeah.
And she was at also the same type of coach. If she questioned something, you really had to stop and like roller decks in your head about that rule, whatever. And you have to do that in a nanosecond. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have this big delay. So yeah, there's certainly times when things happen, you see it, you know it, you blow it, because it's like muscle memory at this point. And then you have to deliver it. And you hope that you have the right rule. And I am actually very lucky, because for probably close to four decades, I also run the training clinic for Westchester Putnam. So anybody that wants to become a girls' high school official comes through my class. I have a co-clinician now, John DiVenere, who's huge help to me. So I have to have my nose in the rule book in September every Wednesday night. We're in the classroom. We're going over the rules. I'm on the state executive board, so we help write the test along with the state interpreter. So there's a lot of knowledge that, you know, I tell my candidates the first night of the class, there's 6,273 things that you need to know when you're reffing. And they think it's a joke until we start going into the rule book, going out onto the court. One out of bounds play has like 23 things that you have to think about all at the same time. Shot clock, game clock, line, verticality, defense, offense, who's going which way? What's the score? How many fouls does number four have? She's their best player. I'm not saying we're playing favorites, but you want to make sure if you're going to call the fifth, make sure it's a foul, a legitimate foul, not a ticky-tack. So there's just so many things going on, and I wish that fans knew that it's a very comprehensive, and you really do. You have to love it. I mean, and you have to love it in order to do what you do. We have to listen to things that we don't always like to listen to. I tell my candidates, the best game you do is when you leave, nobody even knows who you were and that you were there.
You get in and out of the gym, right?
Get in and get out. And if they don't know who you are, then you've done a good job.
Now, referees, I know some refs who call every little ticky-tack. Yeah. The rule book says you can't touch his shirt. That's a foul. How do coaches adjust to that? Or if you're working with somebody like that, your partner, for example, how do you adjust to that? Because the teams have to expect consistency from the officials, that what one calls, the other will call too. So if you call the game one way and you have a partner doing something a little different, if I'm the coach of one of the teams, I might be saying, hey, but he said that's no foul. He let that go. Or yes. He called a foul there. How come you're not calling a foul?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that you have to be consistent, but your sense of consistency and judgment changes at every game. If you have two lower level teams, you have to, in your pregame with your partner, we discuss these teams. Neither of them have, you know, they're 10-1. They can't, really are having difficulty getting that ball across. You know, let's like ease up. We don't have to call every single thing. I mean, if it's a blatant travel, it's a blatant travel. Let's ease up on the 3 seconds if we can, unless they gain advantage. And then the next day, you can have two highly competitive teams, like a legitimately almost college level play. And your pregame is, all right, listen, we got to be on top of things. I've had this before. I noticed this about this particular player, you know, leans in on her jump shots, or let's look for this, you know, whatever it may be. But the beauty of that is it changes at every game. Anybody who thinks they're going to walk in and just call every single foul, every single day, every single walk, every single, the coaches, I don't think they want it, but they definitely want and deserve consistency in that game, in mm-hmm. that gym, on that day.
What if the score is 72-38, you got 4 minutes and 58 seconds to go? How do you call that if things start to get physical, if one team, the team that's losing by 40 points, for example, and it's happened to them before and they feel like they're getting it rubbed into their faces, for example, and the coach doesn't like that. The other team still has starter on the court, or maybe, you know, somebody who comes off the bench but is a rotation regular, where maybe The kids at the end of the bench should be in the game. The third stringers by this point. How do you handle that at that point, at that time?
I think for officials, that's one of the most frustrating situations because we're objective. We have no interest in who wins or loses the game. We just want to be fair and implement the rules. In those situations, and believe me, they have happened, you have to, I talk to my partner on a dead ball. I'll say, listen, we need to tighten it up. They're getting frustrated. Sometimes we'll go to the team captain. I say, listen, I understand. I went through this when I was a player, but we need you on the court. You're the one who's holding everything together. So you get upset and you have to be, technical foul and you have to go to the bench. You're not helping your team. I don't say it in that length of time because I don't want to be too obvious, but you diffuse and you prevent things from happening. But in that situation, sometimes you have to tighten it up. And also in that situation, I may tend to really tighten it up on the team that has 72 points and is still pressing in that game. Then, just to get a message, I'm not being vindictive, but what are we doing here? What is this about? This whole concept of sports and sportsmanship, and we're building character and we're building teamwork. So, and I'm an educator. So it's, and I'm a parent. So there's all of these things that we bring with us to the court. The very first game I had in CYO, I was with my sister. And the score at halftime was, I'm going to say it was 32-0. And they were the little girls. And I felt terrible. And in the third quarter, they came out and the team with zero scored a basket. And I stood on the court clapping. And my sister came over almost like stage left with the hook. You can't do that. Stop that. You can't do that. You're a ref. And I was like, I forgot. I forgot I was a ref. I became the spectator, which is one of the biggest things to overcome as when you become an official is stop being a spectator. If you're following that ball instead of your designated area, your primary area of responsibility, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Muggsy Frena, women's basketball pioneer, especially on the officiating side of the court, will be inducted into the Westchester Sports Hall of Fame November 15th. Muggsy, why does it seem like every coach, and they know that they might be wrong when they complain about a call, why do they all act like I have to have every call, every single call? I'm right. I'm complaining to the ref. I may be pretending that I don't like this, but I want that call or I want to set it up for the next one. Why do they go through all this? I see sometimes, over at the scorer's table, I see coaches complain about things and I say, and we say at the table, there's no way the coach could possibly believe that he should get that call. What's the point at that point?
I think, because I also was a coach, I coached the boys at St. Eugene's, and I became a very different person as a coach towards officials. I think they think they're going to get an edge. At some point, they're going to badger you enough that they're going maybe to get an edge. And some officials, they may give in to that. I don't, because I have this innate ability. I don't know where it came from. I don't hear them. When they constantly are constantly chirping, something happens and I don't listen to them. But the ones that every now and then say, wait a second, I'm going to stop and I'm going to think about it. I did a sectional game years ago with my good friend Donna Spafford. Those days it was held at SUNY Purchase. And it was Lourdes and it was Nanuet. It was an incredible game. The place was packed. And the play is happening and everybody is screaming. The whole place is screaming. The horn is buzzing and you can't. It's a live ball and I'm blowing off the horn. I'm saying, stop, stop. And then finally, the Nanuet coach comes out on the court and I'm about ready to give him a technical foul. And I turn around and there's like 25 rolls of toilet paper that were thrown out on the court. But it was to my back and my partner, we were so focused on this half of the game, this end of the court, we had no idea. So the amount of focus and dedication, I wasn't listening to all those people screaming at me, and that was the one day I really should have been listening.
Mm-hmm. So it does make a difference if, let's say, your fellow Hall of Fame inductee Bobby Cimino over at Mount Vernon, who's coached the boys team for a couple of decades there and through several state championships. If a coach like Bobby Cimino were to say, hey, Muggsy, can you take a look at this? That matters who the coach is.
I don't know if it specifically matters. When a coach calls me Muggsy, I'm uncomfortable with that because that means we have, like, we know each other. But the truth is, I am friends with some of the coaches and have been, you know, and back in the day when we first started, we could talk to coaches, we could shake the coaches, we could go out for a hamburger after, you know, and all of that changed. You can't talk to them. You can only think. They only can talk to you if they ask you a question, which is that's a little bit too much. But yeah, I think it depends on how they ask, how often they ask, and what it is that they're asking. If it's perpetual, I kind of just let it go because there are coaches in Section 1 right now that question every single call.
They cry wolf.
Yes, on every single call that doesn't go their way.
And when it is wolf, that may work against them because they always do that, right?
Yeah, yes. And you know, just the way coaches speak, referees talk, we'll have a pregame and we're not coming in with any predisposition about what's going to happen. But we might say, oh, by the way, you know, I had this team last week and, you know, they're whatever. Or, I mean, one game, the AD came in and said, you know, we have a problem with a fan and we're going to try to contain him. And I said, oh, okay. And then all of a sudden the state troopers came in. I thought, oh. And I was working a game with a former Super Bowl championship, Larry, I can't think of his last name, out of Dutchess County. Very, very big guy. So I thought, well, I'm in good hands today. We're not going to worry, you know, too much about what happens. So stories you want to share that, okay, you know, this school has a very irate parent and, you know,
no
we have to stop
about
it.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, yeah. You have to stop that. You have to stop it and you need the support of the schools. And there's a big initiative this year out of New York State Public High School to expand their zero tolerance policy. So we hope that that helps.
Mm-hmm. Some innovations along the way. I've done some work for the Westchester Knicks. I was there the night about 5 years ago where they went to a four referee setup in the G League to try it out. And I said to myself, I walked around for hours before the game saying to myself, how's this going to work? How are they going to fit four refs on the court? And then the game started and each ref started right at midcourt, one all the way left side, one all the way right side. On each side of the court, there are four refs. They patrolled their side of the court, their wing of the court, between the hoop and half court, and that was it. And I looked at that. I said, pretty simple, huh? Why didn't I think about it?
Yeah, I'm trying to envision that. It sounds like they're assigned quadrants.
Yeah, all quadrants.
Which is interesting because does that mean you can't take your eyes off that quadrant when there's like an overlap between your quadrant and the backcourt quadrant.
That's what it seemed like. You keep your eyes here in this section from the middle, from half court down, all the way down to
the base.
And that's it. And that's your section, that side there. And that's it. You worry about that. And they walk kind of robotically up and down the court, no matter what might be going on in the court. They kind of walk very slowly back and forth the whole game. No running.
I would suspect coaches wouldn't want that because to me, I don't know what the data is, but it seems to me there would be many more calls with four officials assigned each to a quadrant. Because as an official, this has happened to me. It's happened to all of us. You go out, you toss the ball, your partner has the first four calls. And I'm saying to myself, is my head not in this game? Like, what's going on? They happen to have been in his primary area. And that means he's doing his primary area of responsibility and I'm off the ball on my primary area. And then when the ball comes in, my shoulders turn. This is now my area. And he or she, by watching me turn, knows I've got this. And now he or she has off the ball. So it is really intricate. I have never seen and don't think I will four person crews because I can't imagine if you miss a call with four officials on the floor.
What about the replay machine? How has that worked out, do you think? And, you know, I work in G League as the public address announcer. you are, at least when I've done it, you are the guy that handles the replay screen. When it's time for a replay, you are the guy who lifts the screen up, tilts it to the official who will look at the screen, and you're the one holding it there until they're all done.
I think the videotape replay is really fair. I don't think it's abused. I think if it's the speed of the game is so now, even at the high school level, at the, you know, the competitive high school level, and certainly at the college level, which I've done, the speed is so fast. And if that is that close that the coach wants a review, and they do the review, I think that helps the game. I think it helps the integrity of the game. Mm-hmm. And, we don't use that in high school. But it, you know, it's gone in at the college level. And I think it's, you know, I think it just, it, it just helps. And it's limited. I mean, you can't have, you know, 10 appeals to go to the videotape, obviously. I think it's helped the game. And I think it's just helped the integrity of the game.
How else and has I think, the game yeah. changed through the decades?
Well, there has, in terms of girls basketball, it's changed massively, as I spoke about earlier. The level of play, the level of commitment, the off-season training, the off-season camps and programs that are, you know, for basketball, you could do this with all sports. When I was just started, you played basketball, that's it. You know, you'd move on to softball, or you might move on to soccer or field hockey or whatever. But I think a lot of players now, they zero in on one sport. They are very dedicated. Their parents are very dedicated because they're driving them all over the East Coast for AAU games and whatever. I think, honestly, the level of play is just, it just keeps evolving. And if, as someone who knows the rules from a girls basketball official's perspective, I find it interesting over the last 10 or 12 years that the boys' rules have shifted a little bit closer to the girls' rules, in terms of, like, we were the first ones, I believe, to have a shot clock. And we, you know, I can't even think of, there's a number of situations that the Federation has shifted a little bit and come over to a little bit closer to the NCAA rules. So there's not a whole lot of big differences, certainly not at the high school level. But yeah,
I don't see the blowouts in girls basketball like we saw 30 years ago, which I would feel sorry for the players on the losing end. You'd see games 82-16 back then, 30 years ago.
Yes.
In the 90s.
Yes. Yes. You still see some of that a little
Once
bit, but
in a
it's,
while.
It's
rare now, I think.
But it is more rare, and it, you know, sometimes, you know, statistics have entered it, and somebody's got to get to their 1,000 points, or somebody's got to get to their whatever, which is great and it's admirable. But I, as an official and a spectator looking, those games are disappointing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure what the lesson is there.
What are the most interesting things that players or coaches or maybe an officiating partner has ever said to you on the court? The most memorable things you might have heard?
Well, I did, in a three-person game, have one partner come over and tell me that he was going to punch out the other official. And I said to him, in the locker room after the game or the parking lot, that's your decision. You are not doing that on this court. I don't remember what led, you know, you can work with people that can frustrate you because maybe they're calling every ticky-tack, or they're not calling anything, or they're calling a three-point shot from the free throw line at the backcourt. They're saying it's three and you're there and it's not a three. Sometimes that can happen. It's unusual.
I'm trying to remember, like, something that's particularly funny. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are, John, but I've done so many games over so many decades that it's almost hard to remember. But usually I'll leave happy, content, there have been times where I've driven home and for 3 days I'm going over the books and I didn't get that right. I don't think I got this right. I shouldn't have made that call. Until a friend of mine finally said to me, that's it. I'm done. Don't talk to me anymore about it. Mm-hmm. She said, you're a terrible ref. You missed a call 4 days ago and you're still talking about it. Just stop. So I was like, okay.
How have you ever had to tell a coach, all right, coach, that's enough. I got to sit you down right now or I'm going to keep
twice
and you're done. Too many times, probably, right?
I've had to do that and I've had to eject. Yes. Yeah. You know, there comes a point, and I will say this at the beginning, when I first started officiating, there were many more female coaches. And then over the years, male coaches came in. And sometimes in my early days, because I was the female with a male official, I would get the heat. And so you almost have to prove yourself a little bit more than you should, I think. And then I started to realize as I got better and I was doing regionals, state tournaments, doing Madison Square Garden, Meadowlands, they weren't coming after me anymore. But I did notice if one person is tall and the other person is shorter, they're going to go after the shorter person. If one person's older and one person's younger, they're going after the older person. It's to gain, in their minds, I think, I'm speaking for them and I shouldn't be. Maybe they're just looking for some type of an advantage or some kind of thing that's going to help them get whatever it is they want. And usually that's a win.
Mm-hmm. I look at Smush Parker, one time New York City high school and street court star who made it to the NBA, didn't have the kind of career in the NBA we thought he would, but he was a championship player in the Lakers backcourt among other teams that he played for. And the last number of years, he's been working his way up the referee ecosystem. His goal is to be an NBA ref. And he says the most definitive thing he learned, first of all, he's garnered so much respect for referees that maybe he didn't have before. That's the first thing. And the second is, he said, no matter whether your call turns out to be right or wrong, make your call definitive so that you cut down the possibility of objection as much as possible.
Absolutely. You have I tell the candidates in my class every year, when you make the call, you sell it, especially if it's a block charge or it's something you have to be very demonstrative. And that gives the message, you got it right. And sometimes you're not. I mean, obviously we're human. So sometimes we don't, but I think that, you have to be confident in what you're calling, even in your head, you're going, I think I just blew that. But again, everything is a nanosecond. But, you know, I have two great success stories that came out of my clinic. One of them is doing the MBA now, and he's doing the WNBA now. He's doing the NBA Summer League out in Vegas.
And
he started Kevin Fahey. His name is Kevin Fahey.
Yeah.
And Kevin started with my clinic here in Westchester. His dad and mom live actually a few blocks from here. His father was a longtime referee. And then I had another one. This was a great story, I think. I was running the clinic. I think I was at East Chester High School. And this young African-American young lady comes in. She has a baseball cap on. She sits in the back. She fills out her registration. And we go through the whole class. She has nothing to say. She's quiet. Class is over. Most people are leaving. And she comes up to me and she said, you don't remember me, do you? And now I'm like this in my head. No, just remind me. And she said, I played for Mount Vernon High School. I said, oh, okay. I was probably your ref. And she said, you were my ref. And I said, okay. And she's very serious. And she said, you gave me a technical foul. And I thought, here it comes. She's got something she's been waiting to say for 6 years because she went to college. And I said, did you deserve it? And she said, I absolutely deserve that technical foul. And I just finished college and I want to come back. I want to tell you that you were right. And I want to become a referee. And she went, Rachel Jones was her name. She went, stayed with us a long time, went to the collegiate level, Division I official, cover of Referee Magazine, sadly passed away from breast cancer. But you know, to turn on the TV and see somebody that you started or you had some little effect on at the beginning of their time. And I stand on the shoulders of a lot of women who were back in the day supportive of me. It's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And I love doing it.
Does Peter Dish still referee?
Yes, he does. He is
Peter
in our association.
Dish was my high school gym teacher, our high school basketball coach. We were his first class out of school in 1970 at the old St. Agnes in Manhattan. And Peter Dish keyed me up at the end of an intramural game when I was a senior in 74, where my team was expected to go all the way. We had a key injury and we were being eliminated in the final minute of a game on a controversial call. And I said to myself, I think he's right, but I'm the captain and I have to say something. And I went berserk and he teed me up. And when that, I said, if he hits this tech, we're done, because the kid still had to take his two fouls.
Yeah.
And he hit the tech. And I said, we're done. We're not going to the playoffs. He hit two foul shots, the kid, and we
were
like 9 or 11, whatever it was, with just seconds to go that was. And the game ended, and I went over to him, and I said, why did you give me that tech? And he said, because, Marino, the game was over at that point when you did that, and you were just the comic relief.
I oftentimes would love to write a book just from the little quips of officials and what they say to players and coaches to diffuse that. Really, once you calm down, you actually laugh about it because, mm-hmm. you know, there are so many, you know, there's, you know, coaches are yelling, look at the fouls, you know, it's 5-0. And, you know, have officials will say, well, I can count. But 5-0, like what the other team hasn't touched a player, you know, whatever the situation is. But yeah, there have been, you know, I have been told back in the day to, you know, go home and cook for my husband, you know, and stay in the kitchen. I experienced those things in my early days. But I understood that they're just, you know, they were people who just didn't get it. And hopefully they've evolved.
I have to say, he let me go in a few other instances where he should have teed me up. So that
maybe
a little makeup for what happened in the past before. Yeah. Margaret Muggsy Frainer, class of 2023, Westchester Sports Hall of Fame, to be inducted November 15th, Glen Island Harbor Club. Muggsy Frainer, congratulations to you, and we'll see you on the 15th over at Glen Island for tickets for the induction. Get in touch with Kevin Cook, Westchester Department of Parks, Recreation, Conservation at kdc2@westchestergov.com. All the best to you. We'll see you on November 15th. The event now not hosted by me any longer. I guess I'm in an advisor's category now. Kevin Devaney of Local Live TV is the host. We do a TV-style production now, which Kevin puts together, and I know when he talks to you about that and putting that together, that'll be quite an experience. It'll be quite an experience to see the way he does all that on November 15th over at Glen Island. Here on the Sports Report, Westchester Talk Radio, I'm John Marino, produced by Shark Creative, made possible by Robeson Oil, the house that service built by Michael Labriola, landscape design and construction of Armonk, by White Plains Hospital, and by Hightower Westchester, managing your wealth to a fiduciary standard. Download our app, take it with you 24/7. It's called Westchester Talk, and catch all of our programming on Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, Dutchess Orange, and Fairfield County Talk Radio, all online. And yes, we are now on Apple Podcasts too.